Hello, Gemini, and welcome to Cosmophilia, You Belong Here, your Planet Waves 2015 annual reading. My name is Eric Francis. Very happy to be here with you today. I want to start with a little bit, as I'm doing with every sign, a bit about here, what here means, what here now is about in the context of astrology. But I want to go further back than I've been going with a lot of the signs, which is, you know, maybe somewhere between, you know, 7 years, 2 years, sometimes 20 years, and go back to the beginning of the zodiac and say something about how Gemini is, I believe, the sign that exemplifies the human condition. The zodiac myths are like the proto-myths of astrology. They're very old, and they seem to be the stories that emerge from this kind of foggy oral tradition. The origins of the myths are not all documented. Some of them are not really documented at all. How those particular constellations became associated with signs is an interesting question. And ultimately, we are the inheritors of a story. We get a story, and the story is primarily told in the form of the wheel, of the signs, irrespective of the placements of any planets. The placements of planets bring drama to the stage, but there's a cycle of stories far in the background that really is setting the scene for everything that we think and everything that we do astrologically. And if you think of the zodiac as beginning with Aries, a ram, the sun travels 30 days through the sign Aries, and then it moves on to Taurus, a cow or a bull, and we get another theme. 60 days have gone by, and we haven't seen a trace of a human being. Human being shows up on day 61 of the solar year, counting from the Aries equinox, and when a person shows up for the first time, there's two of them. Not just one, but there's two, which personally, in my twisted sense of humor, I think is one of the funniest things about the zodiac. And I don't mean funny as in odd. I mean funny as in reflecting the understanding that the people who came up with the zodiac had about the human condition. So we get humans, and there's, in the human condition, two, which can mean a lot of things. It can be a reference to the inner dynamic of self and other. It can be a projection of the outer dynamic of self and other. In the formal Greek myth, the twins, of course, are Castor and Pollux, and one is mortal and one is immortal, and it describes that relationship between the mortal self and the immortal self, which the ancient Greeks and their predecessors who gave us astrology, Alice Bailey says it's the Atlanteans, were saying, here's thing one about the human condition. Mortal self, consciousness of, immortal self, consciousness of, how about that? And the funny thing is, when you look at the statues made in antiquity of Castor and Pollux, they really are identical. And so that kind of cosmic joke comes along. Now, there is more to the description of the human condition, you see, in Gemini. And I think that it has to do with the positioning of Gemini in the solar system and in the astrological wheel. Now, that changes. This orientation changes very gradually over time, a fraction of a degree in a century, maybe a little bit more than a degree in a century, till the whole zodiac itself goes around once in about 24,000 years. So it's actually measurable year by year if you use very good instruments. And at our time in history, when you stand on the hypothetical zodiac and you stand in the place where Gemini would be and you look straight ahead of you, you are looking into the heart of the Milky Way galaxy. You are looking at the galaxy. You are looking at the central focal point. It's a lot of gravity, holding a lot of stars together, 300 billion stars. They never counted, but that's the estimate, in our galaxy. And when you stand at Gemini, which is the viewpoint of someone who is a Gemini or Gemini rising, you're looking right at the galactic center. You're basically looking at God. And you're seeing this thing outside yourself. You're seeing this powerful, meaningful, beautiful, interesting, strange, alien thing. Now, notably, to my knowledge, there's no record of awareness of the galactic center. That's not discovered until the 1930s. They didn't realize there was like a galactic center. Kind of amazing. And it was discovered when they were laying telephone wire across the Atlantic Ocean and they were picking up cosmic rays at certain times of day, and they figured out that those cosmic rays were coming from the center of the galaxy, and that the center of that galaxy is in Sagittarius, your opposite sign. More cosmic humor coming from the Gemini-Sagittarius axis, one of the funniest there is. And that also means that when we look from the opposite point of view, when we look from Sagittarius back at Gemini, we see Castor and Pollux, and we are looking into intergalactic space. In other words, we are perched at the edge of the galaxy here in the Milky Way in our little place. We are in the sticks. We are in a rural area. And behind Gemini is deep space. And I think, in my astrological mind, this tells us something about Gemini, and it tells us something about its relationship, its correspondence to existence, to what it perceives outside of itself over there in Sag, the galactic center, and what it feels inside this dualism between the immortal self and the mortal self. And then there's this huge kind of drama of all of existence, all of creation, all of these unusual, odd, foreign, beautiful things in the other sign. And Gemini is often regarded as the sign of that which is ordinary, the neighborhood, brothers, communication of postcards, your basic elements of life, the family compound, the village, right? And yet, implicit in Gemini is this vast cosmic otherness of Sagittarius. The opposite signs contain each other. They would not exist conceptually or spatially without one another. And each axis tells the story in total. You can't understand Pisces without understanding Virgo. And speaking of Pisces and Virgo, Pisces, Virgo, Sag, and Gemini are the four signs on the mutable cross. And all four of these signs deal with this theme of the resolution of, or the interplay of, opposites. All the opposite signs do that to some degree. But the mutable signs are the ones that are specifically focused on the theme of the interplay of opposites, the resolution of opposites. And the primary reason that they are so is Gemini. Yet, each one of these four signs, all of which make up the backbone of your chart and incidentally make up the main core engine of what is present in your chart this year, because almost all of the interesting activity is on the mutable cross this year. This has been building for a while, but it's continuing to do so. And one by one, things are gathering on the mutable cross. A few notable things move on or spend part of the year on the mutable cross and move on to the Cardinal Cross, which is the next stop, but this Mutable Cross is just spectacular. And anyone born under a mutable sign, which you are, or with a mutable sign rising, either or both, is getting a lot of data input this year, a lot. And so there are going to be numerous opportunities to do this resolution of opposites thing. And very briefly, Gemini, the opposites just kind of talk in their own language. The twins, speech pathologists are sometimes, you know, note in their work, you can even look it up in Wikipedia, that there's this phenomenon known as the ideoglossia, I-D-E-O-G-L-O-S-S-I-A, if I'm not mistaken. And this is the secret language of twins. A beautiful thing, a beautiful concept. I wish I could hear a recording of this. I've never tried to look for one, of twins gabbing away in this language that nobody else understands. It's just their language. Most of them outgrow it. Some rare twins keep that through their whole lives. And I think of this as being indicative of the kind of secret language of thought that you have with yourself, wherein you maintain your inner dialogue. It's also about the way in which you want to form those parabonds with certain people who really do speak and understand your language so that you feel that fraternal kinship with them. If we go to Virgo, the opposites seem to clash. Virgo is full of mystery and full of contradiction. And Virgo is working out duality, but often not aware of the fact that it's doing so. Gemini is fully conscious of working out this whole process of opposition. You can't miss it. It's right there. When you flip open the New York Post, you look at the thing, and there's two little twins there. You can't miss the fact that there's two of something. You know, if you're born under Aries, you might not get that the two horns on the ram are a symbol of dualism. But anyway, Virgo doesn't have any of that symbolism. It is, and it therefore, I think, probably struggles the most with dualism, but its job is to be this kind of processing biocomputer that brings together opposites and kind of mashes them together or tries to integrate them kind of bit by bit of data. You have this on your emotional house, the house of your emotions. And your emotions, like you, can have a very psychological property. That doesn't make any comment on the extremely sentimental side of your nature, which I will hopefully get to. I've done the written portion today, and I comment about that, particularly around money. But when it comes to your sense of grounding, your sense of safety, you want a logical basis for knowing that you have some grounding and some safety and that your space is really your space. And you want to figure out why you feel what you feel. It's not enough just to simply feel and to flow with that feeling. Rather, Virgo on the fourth is saying there must be an analytical element. And this has also been accelerated and by the presence of numerous points and planets. We'll get to what they are at the appropriate time. Next sign, Sagittarius, that resolves dualism by going in one direction. That's the arrow. But the arrow has a little cross through it. The cross through it is the crossbow. And so the dualism works where there are these two opposites, but they fully support each other. The bow is one, and the opposite of the bow is the arrow, but they are in total harmony. Ah, someone figured out an invention, took us nine signs into the zodiac, someone figured out an invention that makes the opposites fully work together and support one another. By the time we move to Pisces, there is a harmonious, sometimes tense coexistence of the opposites and kind of an acceptance of the fact that these opposites exist. Said to be these two fish swimming in opposite directions, and they are bound to one another. There's lots of symbolism in there, but we get an image of two of something, first of all, very similar to Gemini, and a kind of a peaceful coexistence with, or at least acceptance of, the reality of dualism. And as a Gemini, you are switching from mode to mode all the time. It's not just simply that there's twins jabbering away in their secret idioglossia, but rather you have access to every one of these modalities. And thankfully, you are a very highly adaptive person. You can change mental modes, and you can speak languages other than your secret language. And thankfully, above all else, you are driven by curiosity. You want to know. And that is a beautiful thing. Now, going around these four signs, they are the, you know, at least in this chart and many of the other charts in the series, the packed houses in the zodiac: Gemini, Virgo, Sag, and Pisces. The one that I think there are two that are standing out is very interesting. But just briefly going over your chart, your sign, first house, the description of your status in the world at the time the sun enters your sign, we see a lot of energy. Of course, the sun is there, Mars is there. The sun joins Mars, which arrived about a week before. Mercury is present. It's retrograde, which is a kind of extra powerful Mercury spending extra time in Gemini. So you get a lot of time around the time of your birthday with Mercury in Gemini, both retrograde and direct motion, giving you access, further access, to a shifting, evolving point of view that you can experiment with. So there seems to be some kind of a work in progress on a viewpoint. Additionally, you've got a bit there called Asbolus, a long-term visitor to your sign. And the thing that Asbolus gives is the ability to survive survival instincts and the sense of what all forms of life have in common. Mainly, that is the need to survive. Being carbon-based, all the life that we currently agree is alive is carbon-based. No, ghosts are not carbon-based. They're energy, some other form, lighter form of energy, but things in bodies are carbon-based. And that is the burnable or burned symbol of the release of energy. So more energy. And Asbolus is a feisty character and can take a lot. So I think it's one of the grittiest of the centaur planets. We also have Icarus. Icarus is the one who flew too close to the sun and all that. The translation of Icarus in astrology is peak experiences. And so Mars, the sun, Mercury, Asbolus, and other points, there's this drive for peak experiences. And in the first house, it is peak experiences of self. The strength, the impulse, the commitment to expressing yourself. A lot of self-expression and a lot to express. This is combined with a stellar, amazing 10th house. The 10th house probably is the second most important house after the first house. This point could be debated, but it is one of the main kind of taps into existence as it's lived now and as it will be lived in the future, particularly outwardly in the world, particularly where you are seen, known, and recognized for what you do, and in particular for what you do well. It is the house of one's reputation, of one's achievement, of one's work, and it is the house associated with responsibility, what you are responsible for. And Pisces is suggesting here a connection, kind of a karma, of this type of achievement being connected to, first of all, that which is spiritual or mystical, and second, that which is creative and artistic. So it's like the kind of, in our society, something of the kind of ultimate paradox looked at one way, where your house that's, you know, associated with things of an executive nature and presidential nature and of ultimate accountability and responsibility and all that is connected to one of the least materially oriented signs, Pisces, and one of the most creatively rich signs, Pisces. Having Pisces on the midheaven means you must have a creative job. If your job is going to be anything more than just something you show up at and put things in file cabinets or mop the floor, if you are going to aspire to achievement in any way, that must be in a context of something mystical, something beautiful, something elegant, Piscean, something a bit boundless with a lot of possibilities, and I think, you know, most significantly, something oriented on service, all of the above. And that is the story of, at least as told astrologically, your highest achievement. That's what the background looks like. That's where to look. So it's unlikely that something that you personally consider anesthetic, that numbs you, that is boring, is going to be a source of great success for you. And if it is, it's likely that you're going to feed your life in other ways, prominently with another, that other side of other facet will be fed by that creative thing. So you have that ability to bifurcate and to do something that's sort of unlike that, but then that still, that creative passion and aspiration in the direction of creativity must find a home. The thing is now that the calling in that direction is so powerful, so much influence in there, that it is impossible to miss. Pisces is not impossible to miss, but it becomes more difficult to miss, easier to notice, the more is introduced to that sign. And for a while, more and more planets have been showing up in Pisces. And at the moment, particularly on the day the sun enters Gemini, the planets collected in Pisces include four slow movers. This is the thing I'm so excited about, ranting and raving here. These four slow movers are, of course, Neptune. The modern ruler of Pisces is in Pisces. So that's more of that vision, more of the creative material is available. That in itself is no guarantee of creativity, because a lot of times there'll be a 10th house Neptune transit and basically people will not notice that. It will kind of disappear, or things will go wrong in that Neptunian way where there's this kind of dissolving property that no one is noticing until it's too late. But you have a lot of help in the 10th house in Pisces, for example, including Chiron, which arrived in 2010. Chiron's presence in Pisces is a focalizing agent. It is it is like the lens put in front of the movie projector. The way to think about the relationship between Neptune and Chiron, especially in Pisces, is imagine that Neptune is a movie, which it could be because movies are one of the things ruled by Neptune, images, things of a glamorous nature, things of an illusory nature, of which movie is certainly the illusion of movement, even though the only thing moving is the film, not the people. And Chiron is the thing that allows you to resolve the image. It's like the lens in front of the movie camera, projector, excuse me, and the camera as well. It's the lens that allows you to resolve and see the image clearly. So we've got Neptune and Chiron working together to give you both a source of creative inspiration as well as the ability to focus and access that. Now, both Neptune and Chiron have their way of coming with little crises, with overabundance of creativity leading to a sense of being overwhelmed, or Chiron bringing with it a sense of crisis of purpose and possibly not wanting to have so much responsibility. Certainly Chiron in the 10th confers responsibility on basically everyone who has that placement or that transit. There's going to be some need for, you know, hyper-conscious responsibility. In addition, there's a very Piscean point in Pisces called Borsisi, which is about belief. It's about the belief, where belief meets faith, where truth meet lies, where believing things that are true believing things that are not true, not believing things that are true, not believing things that are not true. All those equations are bundled up in Borysthesis. So it's a point of analysis of our ideals. It's a point of analysis of false belief and perhaps accurate belief. And this is covered, by the way, in a book. It's named actually for the sun god in a book by Kurt Vonnegut called Cat's Cradle, which is a kind of analysis of the comparative analysis of the lies of science and the lies of religion and the truths of religion and the truths of science and how all of that stacks up. And taken personally, I think that Borysthesis is about the power of believing in yourself, whether that thing that you supposedly believe in, that talent or whatever, is true or not, whether it makes a difference or not. If you believe in it, it becomes powerful. And Chiron is focusing that. Chiron is going to make the first of three exact conjunctions on, I believe it is March 21st, right on the equinox. And there'll be a second one in 2015 and a third one in early 2016. So the Chiron-Borysthesis conjunction, which if you read about that on any other website or in a magazine, please do email me and tell me that you have read an article on the Chiron-Borysthesis conjunction, because I'm really curious what anyone else has to say about it. To me, anything Chiron touches becomes a conscious process. It's awakened, and the process must be taken up. And I think that the question of Chiron conjunct Borysthesis for you is believing in your own abilities, in your own authority, in your own strength, in your own ability to shape the world, and in your ability to responsibly handle the power that you have, whether that power is created by something of a scientific means or something of a faith means or something of a government or corporate means, another element of the 10th house. Finally, not to put too sharp of a point on this responsibility thing, but Nessus arrives to stay in Pisces this year, and it will be there for 20 years. Things are, a whole bunch of different planets are starting to take 20 years to go through a sign. We live in the era of many, many outer planets. When I started doing this work, there was only Pluto that was way out there like that. Now, suddenly, there's many things, and something that I'm tracking in every single sign of the region of space at Pluto or beyond Pluto orbiting our sun. And one of these things is, well, it's not exactly beyond Pluto, but it's in a very slow phase of its orbit now, acting as if it is beyond Pluto. That would be Nessus. And Nessus is the centaur planet, like Chiron, that drives the message of accountability. The keynote of Nessus, brilliantly deduced by my friend Melanie Reinhart, is the buck stops here. The buck stops here is an important thing when it comes to matters of public accountability, of responsibility, of corporate power, and of one's life mission and reputation. And so the overall theme of this is a lot of creative ability here, a lot of, I wish there were a better word than power, but it is a kind of, it's like a very charged up battery, but it's a creative battery of ideas and concepts and visions. Pisces is extraordinarily visual. It's sensory as well. Music is involved in Pisces, and the sense of smell is involved. Neptune is about gaseous things as well as about like water and earthquakes, but no, that's another story. Nessus's point here is that where there is all of this power and authority and ability and charisma and persuasion and the desire to achieve and succeed, there must be that factor of accountability. The buck must stop with you. The buck, by the way, is not a dollar. It's kind of a odd expression if you think of it as dollar. The buck stops here. What does that really mean? Well, the buck is actually a buckhorn that was used in the game of poker. And the buck would be handed from one player to the next, and when a player got the buck, it was their turn to be the dealer, to deal the cards. And the term passing the buck is when you opt to not deal, you pass the buckhorn to the player to your left or right, whichever way this is done, and they deal. The concept inherent in Nessus of the buck stops here is the concept of dealing. You get to deal. That's a privilege. It's a responsibility. But ultimately, it is a necessity that is integral to your ability to express yourself creatively in this way that seems inevitable for you, that there is so much to express, there is so much to say, there is so much to that you have to offer, and the buck stops with you. Two more points that I want to mention in Pisces, then I'm going to take a little break and we'll move on to Sagittarius and cover some other houses. One of these points is Vesta, which is an asteroid, the brightest of the asteroids, allegedly naked, visible with the naked eye, allegedly naked. Also, too, I wouldn't mind getting naked with Vesta. Visible to the naked eye. I don't know anyone who's ever seen it, but I have read this before. And I'm surprised that it wasn't discovered. It's not mentioned in the ancient literature, since the sky used to be darker 2,000 years ago, and there weren't, you know, were not all these city lights and all this, and airplanes flying around up there. Anyway, bright, bright asteroid about fire, but also about service, and also about holding space. And so the message of Vesta is to hold the creative space open around you. There's more than one person involved in this story. There looks like there is some important collaboration going on. And I would say that it is your job to make sure that the space, be it the art studio, the recording studio, the production room, the newsroom, name a kind of a creative space, the theater, is held open for the creative ritual that is going to happen. And further, that the creative flame is tended. You have Vesta there, at the very least in your own life, it is necessary to tend that creative flame. Okay, one last point that I'm fascinated by, Circe, C-I-R-C-E. And this is about the element of bewitchment, a very Piscean theme. It's like got that sensation of the siren call. It has the feeling of an enchantment. And when we add this to all these other things in Pisces, there is just this reminder that you have a certain enchanting charm to you, but you are being encouraged to use that enchanting charm for service and for things of a truly creative nature, and to use it with caution, care, and judiciousness, and to remember that where your authority is concerned, and frankly, I think that extends into the community around you, the buck really does stop with you. You're the one who has to deal. And so it's a message to take every one of these points on a very high level, each one of them, and think, well, how can I, what is it about, you know, the power of belief that I need to keep in mind here? What is it about the power of the ability to weave illusions? What about this authority I have of holding space and tending the creative flame? One at a time. That is your checklist. Alrighty. I'm going to take a break. I'll be back with you. We'll talk about Sagittarius and Saturn in Sagittarius in a digital instant.